The following is a presentation of the Town of North Hempstead's Project Independence and WCWP. Welcome to Project Independence and You.
Welcome to Senior Talk Radio here on 88.1 FM, WCWP.org. This is Project Independence and You. I'm your host, John Ryan, and my co-host today is Otto Loos.
Good morning, John.
Otto is having a doubleheader. He was here last week also, which is tremendous.
I was. I do enjoy it.
It's terrific. And just before we get to our first guest, I just want to always, which I do in the beginning here, is bring everybody up to date on Project Independence. And it is Town of North Hempstead's initiative to have seniors age in place. The most important thing to remember is 311. Anytime you have a question, even after our guests speak today, if you haven't taken down a phone number, you call 311. The services offered by the town range from transportation for shopping, transportation for medical visits, light work around the house, social work services, educational programs, exercise programs all throughout the town. Literally, there's multiple programs going on every day of the week almost. A program that just is not emulated throughout this country whatsoever. It really isn't.
Yeah, to me, it's a great program. The program itself, per se, doesn't do all the work. The program really is one of referring you or guiding you through the system or through whatever you need for whatever your circumstances are.
Right, absolutely. It's partners.
Exactly.
We have tremendous partners within the town, and actually, on this radio program, the speakers we have are considered partners. And our first speaker today is Lisa Petroselli. And Lisa is the executive director and managing attorney of the Hofstra Law Access to Justice Incubator. Now, that's the longest thing I have to say all day. For the rest of this, it'll be much easier. The Hofstra Law Access to Justice Incubator is a nonprofit affiliate of Hofstra that works with law graduate students.
Correct.
But I'm not going to explain it. It makes more sense for Lisa. Good morning, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. Good morning, and I appreciate your very generous offer to have me here. I'm excited to be here. I haven't been in this radio station since I was in eighth grade.
Oh, really?
That's correct.
Why were you here then?
I was actually a featured speaker on a jazz show when I was very into my clarinet and the woodwind days. But I'm very happy to be here today to talk about the program.
You should have brought your clarinet.
Yeah, we didn't know
be
that.
A little rusty at this point, but thank you. I don't think anyone would want to hear that this time in the morning. As John indicated, Hofstra Law Access to Justice Incubator is a nonprofit affiliate of Hofstra University and the Hofstra School of Law. We were established in 2014, or I should say we were actually first staffed in 2014. And what it is a program for Hofstra Law graduates who are selected through an interview and application process to participate in a postgraduate fellowship with me for 1 year. During that postgraduate fellowship, the idea is that they will have just taken the bar exam, and during the year they're with me, hopefully they will pass the bar exam and then become admitted attorneys. And during the time that they're with me, we are providing civil legal services in Nassau County to eligible residents. And those are primarily in the areas of practice of guardianship for intellectually disabled and developmentally disabled individuals. And also we serve as court appointees in guardianships for generally incapacitated adults. Those are the primary services that we offer, and we do that either on a pro bono, which is a no cost, or a low bono, which is a low cost basis.
Okay. Actually, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. A couple of weeks back, we had Judge Arthur Diamond on.
Yes.
Talking about guardianship and the trouble trying to get guardians now, because years ago there was money that the judge could allocate and pay a guardian. Nowadays, there's nothing.
Correct.
So therefore, guardianship, for the most part, is volunteer.
Well, it depends on the complexity of the matter and the available resources.
Right.
So back in the day, as you mentioned, there were carve-out provisions where people who even got low income, like Social Security and pension, the departments of social services, respectively, around the state, would allow for a small stipend to be paid on a monthly basis for people who were serving as guardians. That has changed, obviously, with the fiscal environment that we are presently facing. So there are many people who are considered indigent, and whose money, their monthly income, is now being sent directly to the, for instance, the nursing homes in which they may reside, and there's no money to pay a guardian. So there is a lack of available guardians.
Okay.
And our program doesn't serve as a guardian. What we serve in those instances and under that statute as a court evaluator or a court-appointed attorney for the alleged incapacitated person. So those are court appointments on that end for us.
Okay. So now what's the difference then with your guardianships?
So the guardianships that we do for the 17A guardianships, which are through surrogates court, are for the intellectually disabled and the developmentally disabled population. We have family members or friends who come to us and actually privately retain us under that statute and under those types of guardianships to represent them in obtaining guardianships for those people to modify existing guardianships based upon a change in circumstances.
So you're not looking for guardians. You have people who want to be guardians basically coming to you.
Correct. For that population. So there's two separate guardianship statutes.
So you're in a very specific niche, if you will.
Correct. And unfortunately, it's a niche where there are not many attorneys who are available to do that at no cost or low cost.
Okay. This would be like a family member.
Yes.
Or a close friend.
Usually we have parents that are coming where their child is turning 18, and notwithstanding the fact that they have some disability, the law doesn't recognize that. And once you're 18, as you know, you're considered an adult, and mom and dad are no longer your natural guardians.
Oh, okay.
So they have to apply to the court to become court-appointed guardians in order to continue to have the ability to make decisions, medical and financial, on behalf of their child, who they've been taking care of their entire life anyway.
Okay. The population that would be going to you, is there a generic way to specify who should be looking to give you a call?
Well, we have a variety of people that come for the 17A, or again, the intellectually disabled, developmentally disabled. I call them ID and DD population. And by the way, I just want to note that the statute very recently changed to be called or to identify them as intellectually disabled, because unfortunately for many years it was still using the rather unpopular term of mental retardation.
Okay.
So thankfully at the end of July, the statute was changed so that that is no longer used as a classifying
name.
As of
July this year?
A couple of weeks ago. Yeah, the statute just changed. President Obama, I mean, not to get off topic, but he had, in 2010, indicated that the federal government should eradicate the use of mental retardation and refer to that population as people with intellectual disabilities. And unfortunately, it took 5 or 6 years for New York State to catch up. But anyway, the type of people who come to us with those type of issues are usually parents and or siblings of the individual who has the disability. Those are for new guardianships, so those are generally for younger people. There are people who come to us with existing guardianships because mom and dad are now older. Mom and dad were appointed as guardian, and they've either passed away or they're no longer able to function as a guardian for someone else because they're either not in the area or they themselves have become incapacitated. So we help the relatives to modify the guardianship so that the brother, sister, aunt, uncle, whoever it is, can now serve as guardian, and then mom and dad can be relieved from that.
Do you have many situations where people there's conflict about who should be the guardian?
We have not encountered that tremendously. Normally, people are on the same page.
When they come to you.
When they come to us. We do have situations. We've been lucky in the past 2 years. We've had situations where even divorced parents have come to us, but they seem to be on the same page. But they're absolutely, we do have one case actually in particular where mom and dad, who were never married, but obviously the parents of the child, the subject child, are not in agreement. And we're waiting to see whether we're going to have to go to hearing on that.
Right.
But most of the time in those particular instances, everyone's on the same page and it's not a contested proceeding.
Okay.
Once a child would be classified as intellectually disabled, and he has a guardian, so I'm going to be the guardian, for example.
Okay.
Something happens to me, I can no longer be the guardian. That's simple, right, then, just to put another qualified person. You don't have to reclassify the person who's being guarded as intellectually disabled?
Well, that's an excellent question. In order to start the process of getting a guardianship, in addition to filing all the paperwork, you're going to need two medical affidavits for the court. And that could be from two MDs, or an MD and a DO, or it could be a doctor and then a licensed clinical psychologist, both of whom have to confirm the diagnosis of the individual. anytime after that, once you have the guardianship put through, and you need to modify it, as long as the original guardian remains in some capacity as a guardian, in other words, maybe you're adding a co-guardian to work with that guardian, or maybe you're removing a guardian but the other co-guardian is remaining, you don't need medical affidavits. If it's a brand new situation, they will either require medical affidavits or an updated psychosocial. Or okay. If the child's in school, they'll ask for an updated IEP.
Okay.
One of the other areas I happen to notice in some of the material preparing for this was that you try to seek and secure health care, appropriate health care. How does that tie in with this program?
So when people are the subject of guardianship proceedings, and I'm going to switch hats now and talk about the guardianship proceedings that Judge Diamond spoke about, which are under the mental health, okay. Mental hygiene law. Many times those are people who are not able to obtain, let's say, government benefits which would cover their long-term care if they're in a nursing home. So we, as court evaluator in a guardianship proceeding, or as the attorney representing that individual alleged to be incapacitated, would take steps to make sure that if there's going to be a guardian appointed, that they have certain powers or authority in order to make sure that those people have or secure the benefits to which they are otherwise entitled. We've had a lot of discussions with nursing homes, with doctors, with nurses, with care providers to make sure that they're getting care in the nursing homes, or alternatively, people who are on community Medicaid as opposed to institutional Medicaid, that people who can remain at home, much like Project Independence wants them to, are afforded any type of home health care or services in the community that they would be entitled to through government benefits.
You'll actually do the community or institutional Medicaid?
We don't do the applications, but we work with the entities that do.
That would do the applications.
Right. So, as you probably, and as your audience is probably familiar, because you've, I'm sure, discussed this at length, there is a bevy of documentation that the Nassau County DSS requires in order to approve Medicaid. So we work with a lot of different people in order to make sure that the subjects of the proceedings in which we are involved get the documentation that they need in order to secure benefits.
I mean, there is that much paperwork. I had some personal experience with it. We actually almost need an attorney to help you get through the application procedure for Medicaid.
And once you turn in all the documents, which are voluminous, they will go through it with a fine-tooth comb, and they will want explanations or backup or supporting documentation for things that they believe might be questionable transfers. So it becomes a very long process.
Right. I had experience with it.
Even for people who have a relatively simple estate.
You know. Right. Well, that's the part. You know, the part that seems, in my mind, confusing. I don't do that, but from a financial point of view, I work with people. I think it's quite easy to see the person that has transferred assets of significance and the person who started 7 years ago with $80,000 in the bank. I don't care where it was transferred to. You needed it to live over the last 6 years. Right. If you started 7 years ago with $1 million, yes, let's see how it went out and when it went and how you moved it around. But so some, and it's unfortunate because the one with $1 million has the lawyer to turn around and go to bat for them because they hit, you know, they transferred it, they gave it to the kids, they did it legally. Mm-hmm. But the other one who only had 80 and literally spent, you could see the Social Security came in and they spent whatever they needed. You see a perfect check going out every month for $800 or something. They're the ones who need your help.
Correct.
Because they really can't afford. And then they're out on their own.
If they're unable to adequately explain whatever DSS is looking for, then they can end up with an imposed penalty on them where they will be disqualified for Medicaid for a certain period of time and essentially means, you know, you're on your own. You're out of pocket until Medicaid will actually pick up and become effective.
Yeah, I don't remember the details anymore, but I did go through this, frankly, for my mother 15, 20 years ago. And I remember it was not a good experience.
No, it's nightmarish. It really is. Yeah. And the only time it works beneficially is if the person's already in a place, if they were taken in via a hospital visit and then moved to then they don't have to come out, then they'll work with you more.
Right.
But if you're trying to get in almost, not voluntarily, but because you're need-based, but you're still at home, it's very difficult.
Well, one of the most important things, and I'm sure, again, you've touched on this in the past, is in order to avoid ever meeting me, certainly in the context of an Article 81 mental hygiene law proceeding, it's very important for people to have advance directives in place. And those are your powers of attorney, your healthcare proxies, your living wills, your HIPAA release forms, because that means that even if you're not able to do the legwork, you'll have someone with boots on the ground who can do the legwork for you in order to get the documents needed to assure that you're going to get the benefits.
Then we're going
to
do it. We're going to take a break. And we can just touch on each one of those in a little bit more detail, because that really is very important. There's no reason for people to wind up in this situation if they could do a little something in advance to prevent it. You're listening to 88.1 FM, WCWP.org, Senior Talk Radio. Here, we'll be right back.